Hi, I'm Matt Bingay. Welcome to a special presentation of stories recently collected at the StoryCorps mobile recording booth in downtown Charlottesville. The StoryCorps booth was stationed on the downtown mall from May 30th to June 13th, and many people had the chance to be a part of this historic project collecting the everyday stories of our time. In a moment, I'll share a few excerpts from the interviews given at the recording booth, but first, here's a little background on the project. StoryCorps is the brainchild of radio producer Dave Isay, and his vision for StoryCorps is to collect about 500,000 stories from everyday people. The concept is simple. You bring a friend or loved one to StoryCorps and interview them for 40 minutes. You then walk away with a CD of the interview, which you keep for posterity. And with your permission, another copy goes to the Library of Congress, where it will become part of a permanent collection of stories gathered from across the nation. Dave Isay plans to spend the next 10 years gathering these stories, and his first stop on this monumental quest was Charlottesville, Virginia. Let's begin with a story told by Julanne Griffin. Julanne came to the booth with her friend Boyd Zenner, and as they were talking about Julanne's life, Boyd urged her friend to talk about her marriage to Merv Griffin, and specifically about the idea that started the television game show Jeopardy!
Tell me a little bit about how you came up with the idea for Jeopardy! After you and Merv got married, because that's pretty interesting, I think.
It is. Well, you know, he was always into game shows. And in fact, the day that Tony, our son, was born, was his first day on Player Hunch, a Goodson Todman show. And so he came up with his own ideas for game shows. But coming back on a plane from my home in Ironwood, back to New York, he pulled out a sheet of paper that had some clefs and, what do you call those things in music?
No, like a staff.
Staffs and clefs. And he started to write things down. I said, are you going to do one of those shows where you have B actors come and do gags and things? He said, well, what's wrong with that? I said, well, why don't you do a question and answer show, an intelligent show? And he said, well, because since the $64,000 question scandal, the government believes that you give the answers, so we can't do that anymore. I said, why don't you give them the answers and make them come up with the questions? He said, like what? Now, I was winging it, me and my guardian angel. And I said, okay, the answer is 5,280. He said, oh, the question is, how many feet in a mile? I said, the answer is 52 Wistful Vista. He said, oh, the question is, where did Fibber McGee and Molly live? Well, by the time we got off the plane, we had a game. And, of course, he did a lot of work after that on it. But then I did cook the dinner for the guys at the office when they came and worked on it. And I helped build the sets and do some questions and stuff. And he was the first one to take money away from you when you miss something. All the game shows up to that time let you keep whatever you'd earned. Not him, boy.
So that was a good grasping American thing to sort of add to it, don't you think?
It was. It made it challenging.
Julanne Griffin talking to her friend Boyd Zenner about how her suggestion ultimately led to the creation of Jeopardy! With a little help from her ex-husband Merv Griffin. Julanne's certainly led an interesting life, and she also talked about a technique she uses to help remember important events in her life. You could call them mental snapshots.
Whenever I know an important event happens, I look at it, and in my eyes, I snap the picture, and I carry it with me for the rest of my life. Even with short-term memory, I can tell you what my mother-in-law and her sisters look like at the airport and things like that, you know.
What are some other ones that you took pictures of in your mind?
I took pictures of my son taking rocks out of Jack Benny's driveway. Well, because he used to collect rocks, and he put them in a basket, and when he took his bath, he would take the rock out, look at it, and then he put it in the water and see how it changed, and then he put it in another basket, and then he'd do that with all the rocks. He had rocks from all over the world.
Do you ever take mental pictures of bad things?
Yes, I do. Yeah, my grandma rolling out cookies when her grandson was on the roof fixing the roof and he fell off. She was on the third floor and he fell off the roof and he went right past her window and she kept rolling out these cookies. She didn't know what else to do. I have that picture. And, I have one picture. My father was a judge, uh-huh. You know, and so people he used to marry people sometimes, mm-hmm. and they call him at the house. Well, one time he was asleep after supper. We would sit there and we would comb his hair. He'd lie on the couch. We'd comb his hair. We'd give him a manicure. The cat would sleep on his chest and everything. And the phone rang, and we said, "Dad, the phone's for you." And he used to wake up sharply, you know, so he got up out of this deep sleep and he said, "You girls go in and do the dishes." And we said, but dad, "No, but Dad, get in there and do those dishes." And he went to the phone. He said, "People are coming to get married." They were just up the block. So the door opened, in came this bride all dressed up in their groom and even a wedding party. And he married them. And then he went to sign the papers, and he looked in the mirror, and he had three pigtails with red ribbons in his hair that we had put in his hair. The bride had laughed through the whole ceremony. He wondered why. So, yeah, that was a picture I took.
Julianne Griffin speaking with her friend Boyd Zenner at the StoryCorps mobile recording booth on the downtown mall. StoryCorps is an oral history project based on the idea that the stories of everyday people are the most important and interesting of all. Here's barber Kenneth Staples telling his daughter Elizabeth about the time he shaved a customer on live TV.
One Sunday, WVIR-TV here in Charlottesville ran a telethon for the weekend to raise money for the Children's Hospital here in Charlottesville, and I think it's named the Miracle...
Children's Miracle Network.
Children's Miracle mm-hmm. Network. And one of the celebrity-type people to answer phones, his name was Terry Holland, and he was the basketball coach at Virginia, and he had quite a record and was well-liked in the community. And after the season was over, Terry would always grow a little beard that only followed the jawline, no mustache, anything. And I used to kid him about his beard. He'd be in for a haircut, and he loved to go fishing, and so he'd grow his little beard. So someone was talking about maybe Terry Holland would shave his beard off on TV and could raise some more money. So I called the station. I knew some of the people there, and volunteered my services to come down and shave him if he so desired. Mrs. Bill Battle, who was the chairman, the word was given to her, and she called me back in a bit and said, "I'm just so excited about it. We're going to make it the finale for the show if you're willing to do it." I said, "I'd be glad to do it." So I went over to the shop and packed everything I needed, and I went down to the station, and they put a Miracle T-shirt on me, and we'd stand in a man named Dave Cupp. He's a TV announcer, would call me on camera, and we'd talk about the shave, and I'd show him a straight razor, and I'd say, "We're going to soap him up," and was hyping the people. So came time to get to the work. So I set him up on a high stool. He's a real tall man anyway. And we had already made arrangements, him being a customer. I said, "Now, Terry, I'm just going to soap it up good and just do a once over and not get in close, and the public will see that it's gone, and that'll do the trick." And he said, fine with him. I soaped him up, and we were ready to go, and Dave Cupp was standing there, and the people were behind the cameras watching, and there was Mrs. Battle standing there. I could see her. I said, "Dave, before I start, there's one thing I'd like to say to the audience, and that is if they would either add to the pledges they've already made or if they would make new pledges, I'll shave Terry Holland left-handed." Well, Terry Holland knew I was a left-hand barber. I'm an oddity in my profession. It didn't make a thing to him. He wasn't worried about it at all. I looked past the camera from where I was standing, and Ms. Battle's eyes looked like saucers. She didn't know what to say. So I started, and I shaved Terry Holland. And at the end of it all, they raised $2,500 more because I shaved his beard off for him on TV. The University Magazine wrote it up and had some pictures of uh-huh. I was doing it in there. So yeah. That was it.
Kenneth Staples reliving his 15 minutes of fame with his daughter Elizabeth Barber. During the time that StoryCorps spent in Charlottesville, 155 people contributed interviews, talking, laughing, crying, and connecting to each other in surprising ways. But not everyone was able to bring a family member or a friend to the booth, And that's where Brett Myers and Nora Levine stepped in when needed. Brett and Nora were the facilitators witnessing these amazing interviews, and sometimes they participated, asking the questions and delighting in the responses. Here is Nora Levine talking with 90-year-old jazz musician Dave Cannonson about his idea to throw himself awake.
You and your wife had talked about what your wake should be like, but then you decided instead for your 90th birthday to have a wake that you could actually attend.
That's right. That's what happened, because so many of my musician friends had, we had a party after they were gone, and I said, too bad they weren't around for it, because it was good parties, you know. So I said, hey, if I get to be 90, we'll have a party, and I'll attend it. Okay, so we had sent out invitations for 200, and we had responses for 190. We had a lot of response. It was a very, very positive thing. It was just nice to have it happen.
That's great. What was one of your favorite moments of that event?
When I walked into the place, first of all, I walked in and I was overwhelmed because they had photographs of all the things that I've done all over the place, photographs of groups I was with and different times of my life and current times and so forth. And my stepdaughter had picked up some musical notes and they had balloons in the place. And I walked in there and I said, wow, and that was it. That was the big spot. And then from then on, it was just a wonderful, wonderful day. I was kind of concerned about whether I would remember everybody's name, you know. I knew I remembered most of the guys, but I was worried about remembering the wife's name. And fortunately, I remembered every one of them. Later, I was able to join the guys in playing, and I sat down with them, and it was really very nice. I played with them for a couple hours. We responded to the wake in the way I thought it would. It worked out fine. It was good for me.
I'm sure you inspired many people at that party to do the same for themselves.
I hope so.
Yeah.
That'd be nice. It'd be a nice thing. I'd like to be invited to one of those parties.
Dave Cannonson telling the story of throwing himself awake to StoryCorps facilitator Nora Levine. People came from cities and towns all over Virginia to take advantage of this opportunity to interview each other at the mobile recording booth in Charlottesville. And a few came from out of state, including one person from Cando, North Dakota. The majority of conversations occurred between family members and focused on family history and relationships. Here's husband and wife Jim Childress and Barbara Payne discussing their happiest and saddest memories.
What was the happiest moment of your life?
It's tempting to, you know, pick things like when we got married or, you know, when we had each of the kids. But, you know, those kind of big times are also riddled with responsibility and fear and anxiety. And I think the times for me that I've been happiest are little times. You know, being the bucking bronco for kids in the yard or just a lot of little things like that that are insignificant by themselves, but are sort of pure happiness.
What was the saddest moment?
I think the saddest moment for me was when I realized Mark was going to die. You know, when he actually died, it was, we'd already sort of dealt with it, I guess, but the moment of being in the hospital and talking with the doctor and realizing that as his organs were failing, that he was just never going to be the same, no matter what, that he was not coming back. That was it for me. What are the happiest and saddest moments of your life?
I really felt the same way that you did. It's kind of like, yeah, having children was great, but, you know, I was tired and I was hungry and in pain and all that, you know, there's all that other stuff mixed in. The moment that I think of is when Evan scored his first, I thought you might be going to say this, but when he scored his first goal on the varsity team at CHS,
yeah.
I think I'm right when I say it was in. And I remember the ball. You know, this is what sports are great for. You know, you're just in the moment with them. I remember the ball going into the goal, and I remember turning to look at each other and just saying, it was Evan, you know?
Yeah.
And it wasn't about the goal as much as just all the years, you know, that we had together raising our children. And sort of this was the culmination. This was the time when we didn't have to be tired or get up in the middle of the night with somebody screaming, or we could just sit back
yeah, right.
and watch them kick it in the goal, you know.
Watch them win the game.
Yeah. And the saddest, I think, was when Allie, when I made us leave our old house, you know, that was the worst times for me, and the regret that I feel in uprooting everyone and leaving our old house. And when we got to our new house, I remember Allie saying, "Oh, Mom, I just remembered how our old house had all the trees growing up all around." And again, it was kind of the culmination of the whole process that made it the saddest moment, just the realization of what I'd done, you know.
Yeah. Can you describe the first time you ever saw your child? Your two children.
Well, I don't know whether it was like the first moment, but I can remember holding Allie and thinking, "Oh my God, what have I done?" The responsibility, you know, and just realizing the responsibility of taking care of this person for the rest of my life, really. And for the first 18 years, assuring that she was safe. And it just seemed like an incredible responsibility, and I didn't know, one that I didn't know I was going to be up to. And the other thing that I thought, which was equally powerful in a different way, was for the first time I saw myself in the chain of life, you know. I'm in the middle. I was no longer at the end, you know, and it was just amazing to think of it, life in that way. So I guess those were what I thought of.
Husband and wife Jim Childress and Barbara Payne discussing the ups and downs of parenting. The relationships between parent and child were a regular staple of many interviews. For instance, John Hines asked his son David what it was like to be a new father.
What's been the most exciting thing for you about having a child and suddenly being aware of the responsibilities? But what about the experience has been special for you?
Well, I think I definitely know the first thing that happened, it was immediate, is that I all of a sudden understood how much you love me. I'd never got it before. I mean, I knew you guys loved me.
You're going to make me cry.
But I mean, just to finally realize how much sacrifice and how you guys would do anything, you know, and just to all of a sudden know the depth of love that I have, that you have for me and that I have for this guy. And then just to watch him laugh, I mean, it's incredible. And I can see you in his face, you know, and I can see all of our ancestors, you know, when I watch him laugh. It's just, it's better than any other experience, you know.
I know what you mean. That's the way I felt, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, when you came along. You and Natalie have been the great joys of my life. And now these grandchildren, both little Conrad, little Maggie, what fun!
Yeah,
to see them develop and grow, and not not being as involved to the point that you know, you go crazy. They're driving you crazy, or that you're worried sick about them being sick because you're on call right then. But sort of having the distance of being a grandparent.
Sure.
It's luxury. So you know, hey. This baby needs change and take him.
John Hines and his son, David Hines, talking about feelings of fatherhood. Many mothers and daughters also had conversations about the joys and pressures of parenthood. This is an excerpt of the interview Cindy Walters conducted with her mother, Wanda Walters. Wanda lost her parents and grandparents when she was in high school.
What are you proudest of in your life?
What am I the proudest of? Holding on,
being what I am today in spite of it all. I'm proud of my three children. It's just amazing what they have accomplished and where they are today and who they are today. And there is no hint of where they're coming from. And that's me and where I'm coming from.
Do you want to tell us if you have any regrets?
I do have regrets. I would have had to been Miss Perfect if I didn't have regrets. So I made mistakes. I regret that I didn't just entirely devote my time to my three children. It was quite a chore having three children. But there were other things important to me, too, like keeping the house clean. Now I know better. You know, I should have been standing on my head, rolling on in the grass with my children, and I would have been more my children's, a part of their lives. Although I was, and I wasn't, you know. There were other things that were important to me, too. Now I know they weren't important.
Any words of wisdom for your grandchildren?
Oh, my goodness, my grandchildren. Oh, I would tell them that life is so short. Believe me. I was in high school just a few months ago, and now I'm 71 years old, and I have no idea where all that time went. It's just unreal. If I could go back, I would concentrate on the fact that it's going to be over with someday. You don't think it's going to... You think you have all the time in the world, but you don't. You don't. You have so little time. Of course, that would probably scare them to death, so I probably wouldn't say that to them. They would think they were going to die tomorrow, wouldn't they? But that's the only thing I can say. Think about it. Think about how short time is and make the best of it.
Wanda Walters speaking with her daughter, Cindy Walters. The relationship between mother and daughter was also the subject of Kimberly Johnson's interview with her mother, Katherine Jackson, who at the age of 53 recently graduated from UVA with a Bachelor of Interdisciplinary Studies degree.
How do you see yourself?
That's a very good question. I see myself as this bundle of energy just busting loose everywhere. I feel like the Lord has put an incredible gift in me, and I have to use this gift to bring other people along. I see myself as a helper, as a nurturer. I feel myself as a person that needs to support anybody that needs to be supported. I don't see myself as being an enabler, although I used to be that. I no longer see myself as that, and I can't go there in the long run. But I see myself as, a person that, a helper. I guess I need to help people, guide people to that bright light, whatever that bright light is. I feel like I need to help them get there. And it's not that if by doing that it makes me a better person, but it's just that, as I told you earlier today, to whom much is given, much is required. I think a lot has been given to me over the years, and I need to give that back.
I can't carry it with me. You make sure your kids give on your behalf.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's your turn. You need to do that, too. How do you see me?
I see you as strong. I see you as intelligent. You are very analytical, but you see things in pieces and you're able to plop the piece right there. And I'm looking like, Mom, what is that going to be? And you're like, that's that. You don't see that? And I'm like, no. And then you go and do a little bit more and you plop another piece. And then as you start to do these things and then it comes together, I see that, you've grown up a lot. Your last year of college. I mean, it's interesting. I feel like I'm the parent and you're the child because I've seen you come alive with a lot of things that we've tried to explain that you couldn't quite grasp. And I think being around a bunch of youngsters that you didn't know, it was easier to accept the taste of the medicine. And you've become this big flower and you just blooming. You're just very strong. not as emotional as you used to be. You're very good with that, and you're calming. A lot of patience, more so than what you used to have. And you're a helper, but I don't. The less fortunate, I think. I don't think you deal too much with those that can help themselves. I don't think
they don't need tolerance
and patience for those people that feel sorry for themselves. I think you expect to kick them in the butt, and if they don't see the light, they won't, kind of thing. Which is all good, and I think we all have qualities of that. And stubborn and persistent. I mean, 53, you got a college degree. I know a lot of people that are 35, and it's like, I'm too old, I can't do it. Mm-hmm. And goal-oriented. So I'm proud to have you as my mom. You look younger than my friend's mom, too. That helps a lot.
Thank you.
All your teeth?
Yeah,
all your hair?
Teeth,
all your
well,
skin? Hey, keep it going. I know what I'm going to look when I get your age.
Katherine Jackson speaking with her daughter, Kimberly Johnson. Monday, May 30th, Memorial Day, was a special day at the StoryCorps mobile booth in Charlottesville. A few veterans came in that day and shared memories of life in the military and experiences overseas. Ed Imhoff was stationed in the Philippines during the Korean War, and his daughter, Kat Imhoff, grew up hearing about the exotic places her father had been. In this excerpt from their interview, Kat explains that those stories did have an effect on her.
Well, I think for me, all the stories growing up didn't make me want to join the military, so you were successful there. But that idea of faraway places with strange-sounding names calling me, you know, is what I thought got me to go to India, has made me have my own personal adventures, sometimes adventure meaning something where there is risk in it. And I think it's maybe a genetic condition of some restlessness. That sense that there's always something else around the corner, something on the horizon. I will always be a little jealous at the uniqueness, because I think you got to see some things that aren't in the world anymore. But I right. also think your love of the landscape, whether it's the jungle or the mountains, I definitely picked up, and it's a real part of me. So the stories were worth it.
Good. I remember my rivers. I can see every bit of them in the tributaries, the Libong, the Hebong, the Mombatik, the Maasan, the Adgawan, the Kalo. And I can see all the trails, and they're indelible. And I see the faces. And that's a good memory bank to have.
If you could go back to one day in your life, what would it be?
I suppose I would go back to standing, getting up in the morning and waking up to the whole world. There's nothing like a tropical, in the middle of nowhere in the tropics, in the jungle, a sunrise or a sunset. The sunrises are the best, and I would hear the young lady at the prow of the dragon ship singing across the water, and that moment would freeze, and I would be young and careless and in a way, and I would be enchanted again.
Kat Imhoff talking with her father, Ed Imhoff, about his time spent stationed in the Philippines during the Korean War. Hayden Hollingsworth also shared a story involving family military history. Here, Hayden tells the story of his grandfather's childhood and struggles for survival during the Civil War, and his desire to find the grave of his great-grandfather, who died in the Civil War.
He would tell me stories of hiding in the woods at night when the Yankee troops were going through, taking everything that they could find and burning every house they encountered, and how it was like a sunset for almost a week. The sun never went down, the glow from the burning of the city. But they escaped with nothing left except their lives. And here was this woman with four little children trying to scratch out a living in that sandy soil. And if you've ever seen Conyers, Georgia, it's not a place to grow anything. But survive they did, and I had a close relationship with him on up until his latter years. He was in his 80s when he was telling me these stories. When he was 90, he decided he would like to come to Virginia and find his father's grave, decided to go up to Fredericksburg near the Battle of the Wilderness and go through all those Confederate graveyards. Well, there are tens of thousands of Confederate graves in this state, and even at the age of 10, I knew that finding his grave would be like stumbling over the Hope Diamond in a junk shop. They didn't find the grave. Well, I forgot about it for 10 or 15 years, and I was visiting in Lynchburg one Sunday in 1987. And my mother-in-law said, after we'd done the Sunday lunch thing, would you like to go over to the cemetery, the city cemetery? And there's an old pest house there that Peter Houck, who was a Lynchburg physician interested in Civil War history, had restored. Pest house for pestilence. It was like a little hospital. So I didn't have anything else to do, so we went. And it was 10 feet by 20 feet or so. But you could see what went on inside there. I can imagine the grisly work. Lynchburg was the largest hospital center in the Confederacy. 33 tobacco warehouses had been converted into hospitals. And down the railroad came the wounded from Northern Virginia. And they died by the thousands. They lay out on that cemetery hill waiting for their graves to be buried. Well, on this particular day, it was a beautiful late afternoon in the summer, and the birds were singing, and the grass was smelling new mown, and there were tea roses growing all around, and it was a perfectly tranquil place. And I went up to the graveyard, and there were 2,300 Confederate soldiers buried there, and 30 Union soldiers. Can you imagine what their deaths must have been like? Well, the graves were marked with just initials and unit numbers, nothing else. But up in the center of the graveyard was an obelisk. I walked over to see that. Well, that was a mass grave. There were 50 graves, 50 soldiers there lying beneath my feet. And on the obelisk was the name of each soldier in that mass grave, as well as the unit number. I read the first sign, somebody from every state in the Confederacy, turned to the second sign, same thing. But before I turned to the third side, for reasons I cannot explain to this day, the hair on the back of my head stood on end. I turned to the third side, and the fourth name down was J. Hollingsworth, 52nd Regiment, D Company, Georgia, my great-grandfather. I was astounded.
And when you literally stumbled on your great-grandfather's grave in that Confederate cemetery, what were your first thoughts, Hayden?
Well, I don't commune with the dead very often, but that day I did. Here I was, a living bridge standing between my grandfather and my great-grandfather, whose deaths were separated by almost a century, and their graves by 600 miles. And I, without thinking, spoke out loud, "Pop," as I call my grandfather, "Pop, I found him. He's in a beautiful place." And the words that came back weren't spoken truly, but they were just as real as when I used to walk through that town with my grandfather holding my hand. All my grandfather said to me that day by that graveside was, "Yes, a beautiful place." It was an amazing moment.
Hayden Hollingsworth speaking with his life partner, Johanna Henretta, about the discovery of his great-grandfather's gravesite. Hayden is a retired cardiologist and told another story about a very memorable case involving three patients and spanning 20 years.
What sticks out in your mind as your most unique patient encounter?
That's a hard question, but there is one case that I don't think any other cardiologist had this experience. And I remember vividly the lady when she came in. She was in her early 20s, and she had that glow about her that a woman never has except in the early days of her first pregnancy. She was radiant. Well, she had hypertension, high blood pressure, and it was severe. She was in her first trimester, and that was a bad sign. Back in those days, we had just come through the thalidomide era, where we found out that drugs had a disastrous effect on developing embryos and fetuses. So we were very worried about treating her hypertension, but it was so severe that she was in real risk of having a stroke or perhaps even dying from her hypertension if we didn't. So we tried a lot of drugs, and eventually, after a lot of trial and error, we got her high blood pressure under control. But as I was listening to that little baby's heart tapping its way toward a very uncertain future, I was very apprehensive. What were we growing in that womb, this baby bathed in a sea of hostile drugs, a child with no arms or worse? Well, at the 9th month, she went into labor and she delivered a little boy, 8 pounds, 4 ounces. She named him Matthew Lee. And I counted all 10 fingers, and I looked at those little petals of nails on his toes, and I looked at his ear. It was like a flower unfolding in the breath of God, and I was grateful. About 15 years later, another patient came into the office. His trouble was angina, blockage to the coronary vessels, but he wasn't really very interested in doing anything about it. He didn't want to stop smoking and didn't want to take his medications, and 4 or 5 years later, he had his first heart attack. We put him on the appropriate medications, and he went back to the mountains. Well, he came back 3 or 4 years later, and this time he was in serious trouble. He was in severe congestive heart failure. His heart had enlarged to the point that it could barely pump blood. There wasn't anything we could do. If we took out the part of the heart that was damaged, he wouldn't have enough left to live. So we offered him the possibility of cardiac transplant. He wasn't interested in that, but he came to realize that his life was essentially over if he didn't have the transplant. So he reluctantly agreed to go on the list. Meanwhile, Matthew Lee, now 21 years old, was a features editor at his university newspaper. I hadn't seen him since his birth. He was putting the paper to bed one night, and as he locked up the office and took his girlfriend home, all seemed to be well. But when they got to her apartment, he put the key in the door and collapsed on the porch. That night at 1 o'clock, his mother got that phone call that every parent dreads. "Your son's in our emergency room. It looks like he's had a heart attack. He's near death. You got to come." When she got there, it obviously wasn't a heart attack. He had ruptured an aneurysm, a blood vessel in his brain, but his brain was as silent as the tomb he was headed for. His mother had worked in transplant program. So after assimilating this terrible news, she offered him as a cardiac donor, and my patient was a good match. So the surgery was done, and his convalescence was uneventful. He came to my office 10 days later, and I went out to the waiting room to see him. He stood up. He was a shy man, but he walked across the waiting room, and he put his arms around me, and I hugged him. And I could feel through his thin chest wall that heart beating so strongly, that heart that we had almost stopped 21 years earlier, now cupped in the darkness of a new chest. He looked at me, and he said, "This is a miracle." And I said, "More than you know." Shortly after Matthew Lee had died, his mother had come to the office, and she brought a poem that he had written the year before he died. It was called One Night. It went like this. "One night I started thinking about death and what happens when you die. Where does your spirit go? Then I just flipped it over and I thought, well, maybe your spirit doesn't go anywhere. You just die, and that's it, the end. Then I thought, no, that can't be right. For lessons we learn, there's always a prize. Death must be the same." There's a psychiatrist by the name of Robert Pearsall who deals only with transplant patients with the psychiatric troubles they have. And he believes and has a lot of anecdotal evidence that more than a beating heart is transplanted, he's seen personality characteristics come from recipient to donor. Of course, they never met. Well, I read that book, The Heart's Code, it's called, and thought, well, that never happens. But in this case, it did. Matthew Lee was a writer. He was headed to a career in journalism, and I told you about the poem he wrote. My patient was a countryman. he was literate, but he certainly had never had any inclination to write. But after he got the heart, he wrote a book called In Search of the Kingdom. And it's his story about the spiritual change of having this new heart from this young man in his chest. So I came to believe that that was such an unusual encounter where we were guided in so many different ways, not to abort the baby, to try to nurture the patient as an older man to the area where he could have a cardiac transplant, and then have those two hearts come together, literally, one removed and one replaced. And I was struck by the fact that I had been a witness to all of this over these 22 years, and the fact that there is a guiding principle that makes each day a gift that we all must treasure.
Cardiologist Hayden Hollingsworth speaking with his life partner, Johanna Henretta. The StoryCorps project is just getting started, and the ultimate hope is that these intimate moments, shared memories, and glimpses into the lives of everyday people will help historians 60, 100, or 200 years from now truly experience life at the beginning of the 21st century. There's one final story I'd like to share with you, and I'm going to let Greg and Catherine Corbin introduce it.
My name is Catherine Corbin. I'm 52 years old, and we're on the downtown mall in Charlottesville, Virginia, and I'm here with my husband.
My name is Greg Corbin. I'm 57 years old, and I am Catherine's husband and the father of Matthew, who's 10, who's sitting next to me. There's a Little League baseball field in Charlottesville called Brian Calvin Corbin Field, and I would like to tell the story of how it got its name. The story goes back to 12 years ago when Matthew's older brother, who he never knew, died on the field. The story actually began about 6 months before then. When Brian was getting ready for his 9th birthday in January, he started having difficulty sleeping, and he said that he did not want to celebrate his birthday. He said celebrating his birthday would bring his death, and he would never make it to double digits, meaning 10 years old.
And I would come up in the evening after tucking him in bed, and he would say to me each night, "What happens if I die? What will I do if you die?" Every night. I wasn't sure what was going on with him. And I came up and spoke with Greg and said, this is getting morose. All this child wants to talk about is dying. Every night he will talk about dying. And we would talk about it each night. And then when he decided that he didn't want his birthday party, that's when I got worried. And when he said he wasn't going to live to double digits, then I said, okay, we're going to take you in to see somebody. And he was delighted to see somebody. He loved talking to somebody. It was just fun for him. And
well, over the next several months, he got better. And he seemed to be coming out of his depression. And about 2 weeks before he died, he started to say he wanted to have a party, his belated birthday party. But he didn't want it to be called a birthday party. He wanted it to be called a happy spring party. So we planned it, and he wanted to just have two friends. He had a little girlfriend named Jamie, and he had a boy named Cam that had always wanted to be friends with him. But Brian didn't really, he didn't spend much time with him, and it was kind of like he was trying to finish up unfinished business, because Cam had invited him over a few times. Now, during the 2 weeks before the party, Brian did lots of unusual things. He got Catherine's Mother's Day card in advance and a present, and that was due in 2 weeks. Mother's Day was 2 weeks away. And then he also got my Father's Day present, even though that was months away. He got a trophy he picked out that said, "World's Greatest Dad." And He begged Catherine to get it, but she said, it's a couple months away. We don't have to do that yet. He wrote letters to his grandparents, all the things that he'd been planning to do and hadn't done. And he seemed to be getting, his spirit seemed to be getting much better. So it was a couple days before his party, and Catherine came home one day, and Brian had a little red wagon, and he was pulling a red wagon down the driveway, and he had his camping gear on there and his toys and teddy bears. Catherine said, "Brian, what are you doing?" And Brian said, "I'm ready to go on my trip." Well, he'd been talking about going on this trip, and some days it would be Montana, and some days it would be someplace else.
Wisconsin.
And our driveway is very long, so he was about a quarter of a mile from the house, and he was there with his wagon. And I left him for a while, and I came back, and I sat on the driveway, and he was taking two sticks and rubbing them together, trying to make a fire. And I said, won't you come home with me? And he said, "Mom, I have to go away." And I said, "Brian, I'll be so sad if you leave." And he said, "Mom, I can't be a sissy. I have to go." And so I said to him, "How about camping out for a night? How about trying that?" And I said, "Not tonight, but because it's school night, but tomorrow night. How about camping out?" And so that's when he did. He camped out, and he was so proud of himself. And then he woke up, and the next morning was his party, an absolutely glorious day, that May Day. And we had his party. And
so he woke up and was very proud of himself for spending the night and got ready for his party. He went down to his room, and there were several things he did down there that we didn't realize till later, but he wrote letters to some of his friends and put a sign on his door. I didn't realize it till later, but the sign said, "Brian's on a trip, don't worry about me." And then the kids came for the party, and they had a great little party. He didn't want any gifts, but his little girlfriend gave him a kiss, and his boyfriend wrote a song for him, "Friends Forever, Always Together." And then it was time for them to leave, and then it was time for Brian to go on his birthday party. To go on to play Little League. Now, he just joined this team. He wasn't very good, and he'd always was afraid of the ball. He was the littlest kid on the team. But he went down the driveway. I took him, and Catherine was going to join us a little bit later. And we got to the end of the driveway, and Brian said, "I've got these letters to mail on the way." And I looked at them, and I said, "Brian, these letters don't have any stamps on them. You know they won't get mailed." And Brian said, "But Dad, you don't understand. They will get there." So he was very hard-headed, so I didn't argue with him, and we put the letters into the mailbox. And this was on Saturday, and then we went to the baseball field. Now, this was different when Brian got there. He was so brave. He'd always been afraid of the ball and kind of tried to kind of shrink away from ground balls and stuff like that, and he was fearless. He was charging after the ground balls and telling the coach he wanted to be, wanted to play, he wanted to pitch, even though he wasn't that good. And he was really just having the best time. So I was sitting in the stands, and it was his first time up at bat. He got walked to first base. The next little boy hit a triple, and Brian ran around the bases, crossed home plate. Oh, he'd also said he wanted to score a run more than anything. This was his second game, and the last time he got stranded at third base and didn't make it home. So this time he tore around the bases, crossed home plate, and the fans gave him a big applause, and he looked up at the stands, and our eyes met, and he was the happiest little boy I ever saw. He gave me a high five and went into the dugout, and then he collapsed. And the coach brought him out, this limp body out, and I looked at him, and he was blue, and I'm an anesthesiologist, and that's what I do is resuscitate people, and it turns out I resuscitated him when he was born. And I looked at him, and I said, "I think this should be something, he's probably got an arrhythmia of his heart, and I think there's a good chance we can get him back, but something inside told me he wasn't coming back." So we resuscitated him. The ambulance came, which was right across the street.
and then went back to the hospital with him, but they tried to resuscitate him, and he wouldn't come back. Then I went, after he died, I went to the ball field to get my car, and it was the most beautiful spring day I've ever seen, and there was another Little League game playing when I went back, and barbecues going on with square dancing and the picnic shelters around the field. And I was standing in the field looking at the other kids playing, and I smelled the honeysuckle, and the clouds were beautiful, crisp blue sky, and I smelled the barbecue, and I reached up to wipe a tear from my eye. You know, I had vomit, the smell of vomit from Brian when I tried to resuscitate him. When you shock somebody, they often vomit because they go into this, you know, the muscles tense up. And as I wiped my eye, the smell of the vomit combined with the smell of the honeysuckle and the barbecue. And then all of a sudden, everything got very clear. And I've since heard other people describe this in kind of great moments, that I could see everything clearer than I'd ever seen. The colors were clearer and brighter, and the smells were stronger. And I had the sense that everything was okay. I was at peace. And that if I could bring Brian back, it would be for me, not for him, that he had finished. He had finished his job here, and the unfinished business was just mine. So I had that moment. And then I got in the car and drove back. And first thing I noticed when we got home, we had some friends that were there that had heard about the story over the radio, I guess. And they were waiting for us. And Brian was a fan of Calvin and Hobbes. He had read all the books. As a matter of fact, he'd memorized all the books. And if he wanted to tell a story or make a point, he'd say, the original Calvin and Hobbes, I'm not sure that's the name of the book, page 43, and we'd look it up, and the joke there would pertain to what was going on at the moment. So Calvin had a parent's poll that he would do every now and then. And when Brian was mad at us, he'd give us our parent's polls, and they'd be real low. Well, one of the things he did in the room, but when he was after the party, before he went to the baseball field, was he wrote a parent's poll, and he left it out for us. And the first thing I saw was the parent's poll, and he'd given us the highest score, perfect 2,000, and he was sitting there waiting for us. And then he'd also put the sign up on the door, "Brian's on a trip, don't worry about me," that I didn't see for a few days. There were others. The experiences continued, but later that night, his Brian's older sister, who was younger sister, who was 2 years younger, is mentally handicapped. And I went down to tuck her in bed and tried to explain that Brian wouldn't, you know, had died, it wouldn't come back, and wouldn't be living with us anymore. So Lynn, she was having trouble understanding, and I was curled up in bed with her and trying not to cry when I talked. And I said, "Lynn, Brian, Brian's up in heaven now." And I didn't really, I really didn't know how to talk about these things. I wasn't very good about death. I'd always been afraid of it, which I find many physicians are, it turns out. And and Lynn said, he take airplane? And I said, "No, when you go to heaven, you don't take an airplane. You leave your body like a butterfly leaves its cocoon, and you can fly without an airplane." So Lynn said, "Oh," I said, "Brian gone?" And I said, "Yes, he's gone. He's up in heaven." So then she looked up at the ceiling, and all of a sudden, she got this wonderful smile on her face, and she seemed to be able to see something that was up in the ceiling or past it. And she said, "Oh, Brian, see light." And I looked at her. I was trying to understand, what can she see? Well, then I felt this vibration. And the whole room, mostly in my back, but the whole room was vibrating. And I've heard about that vibration since, because I really researched a lot of these things, because I couldn't understand any of this.
It was as soon as I heard, I thought to myself that that's what he was trying to tell us all that time. He was trying to tell us that it was his time.
Yeah, but it wasn't in my belief system that mm-hmm. something like that could happen. So I really feel bad that I couldn't have been there, you know, more for him when that happened. But I'll tell you, there's a group called Compassionate Friends, and that's a support group for parents that have lost children. And people don't talk about this sort of thing very often, but a couple times I've gone in and told the story, and you just tell the story, then you shut up, and everybody goes around, and they all, not all, but about half the parents have things that are very similar, where the child knew about it, or other things that are beyond coincidence that they were afraid to talk about, because it just wasn't... it wasn't something that they felt comfortable talking about. But once you tell Brian's story, the other people chime in, and these stories are everywhere, but people don't talk about them. It's really interesting.
Hmm. And I think after you lose a child, there is a change in your life that is utterly profound. It's as if you've looked at what is the most horrible thing in life and lived through it. And when you do that, nothing can ever quite scare you the same way. And you're not afraid of death anymore. At least I don't feel it anymore. So it changes the lives of people it touches in absolutely profound ways.
Yeah, that no matter what, that seemed to be a common theme amongst parents who had lost children. Is that no matter what their beliefs, whether they said they were atheists or agnostics, but everybody had lost their fear of death. It was not a conscious thing, but it, and what it feels like for me is that something died, but something didn't die. Something is still obviously very, very strongly still there, even though the person died. And once you feel that, you know, you know you've experienced that there's something, a connection that's still there, and that there's something more than just the death of the body. And then after that, you're not afraid to be around other people. Most people are afraid of death and hard to get in and share, and which means you're afraid of lots of things. But once you lose your fear of that, it's much easier to be with people, especially in their most, you know, most needy moments when they're suffering their greatest losses. But that's basically the story of how Brian Corbin Field got its name. It was a dumpy field when Brian played. And a month or two later, they renovated it. And then a year later, they re-renovated, put lights in. Howie Long, the football player, donated money, and they created a second field in name of his mother. So there's Ma's Field.
His grandmother.
His grandmother. Called Ma, and they called Ma's Field, and then Brian's Field, they call Brian's Field. So now when people come and their little kids play Little League and they say, we were playing on this field and it's named Brian Corbin Field. Is that any relation? And then I say yes.
Greg Corbin and his wife, Catherine Corbin, talking about their son, Brian, and the baseball park that bears his name. National StoryCorps Mobile Booth Tour is made possible with generous funding by National Public Radio, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and Saturn. WMRA and WVTF co-sponsored its appearance in Charlottesville, and this special is a production of WMRA. To learn more about the StoryCorps Mobile Booth Tour and how you can participate, go to StoryCorps.net. I'm your producer and host, Matt Bingay.